Radio.
This is Cindy F. Solomon coming to you on April 24th from the San Francisco Bay Area with the Global Product Management Talk, which is curated for passionate product professionals and business owners who want to teach, learn, and network about managing products, including agile practitioners involved with developing, designing, and launching products, brands, marketing, project management, and everyone who cares about the entire product management lifecycle process to guarantee successful products and companies. We are for product professionals who can't leave their desks to engage in product talks on a regular basis. This is a weekly mini product camp Socratic discussion. We have pre-posted questions today. Please join us on Twitter by following at Product Management Talk, ProdMGMTTALK. And using the hashtag #ProdMGMTTALK. Thank you to our sponsor, the AIPMM, the Association of International Product Marketing and Management, which is the hub of all things product management. It's where product professionals go for answers. It is the world's largest professional organization of product managers, brand managers, product marketing managers, and other individuals responsible for guiding their organizations and clients through a constantly changing business landscape. It is the only organization that represents those who manage the entire product lifecycle throughout any industry. For more information, please visit www.aipmm.com. Again, welcome to today's talk, the Global Product Management Talk on the Power of Personas for Product Success. Today we have with us Eric Holtz-Clark, who is the CEO of User Insight, and he'll be discussing how to leverage the qualitative research process for identifying unique evidence-based personas. Eric Holtz-Clark is the Chief Executive Officer at User Insight, where he identifies strategic service offerings and oversees operational excellence and innovation across the business. He brings 20-plus years of experience, which includes working for a variety of successful Atlanta startup companies, including Geomedica, Information America, One Coast, and Prime Financial Services. He has served as a key leader at both Silicon Graphics and CyberSource, and in each of these endeavors, he played a leading role in building teams to execute product development or maintain company infrastructure and operations. Eric has been responsible for the successful launch and support of more than 30 consumer-oriented and internal use products and services throughout the United States, Canada, the United Kingdom, and Saudi Arabia. He has served on the HCI Advisory Board for Georgia Tech, taught and mentored local university students through User Insights Educational Partnership. He's a strong supporter of the user experience industry and burgeoning entrepreneurs and works closely with Georgia Tech students. Welcome, Eric.
Hey, good afternoon. How are you?
Okay. And welcome to our co-host, also Lisa Winter, in the San Francisco Bay Area. She's a project management consultant with over a decade of managing enterprise-wide complex projects and online products. She has traveled the world growing up overseas in Japan and has attended an intensive international school for foreigners, which she believes prepared her well for today's global environment of managing products and projects. She has consulted and worked for many of the Fortune 500, helping them increase market share and improve efficiency. She's also done heavy-duty stints with multiple technology startups from the start of the dot-com era, forging lasting relationships all over the Bay Area, from the North Bay to Silicon Valley. She brings her practical experience in technology infrastructure, organizational development, strategic planning, and change management, with a background in all facets of business, from marketing and sales to finance and IT. She is a certified project management professional and advocate of Agile, is both a certified Scrum product owner and a Scrum master. Welcome, Lisa.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Today we are talking about the terms user types and personas, which are prevalent in the product development, marketing, and research realms. Or how do we create real, durable personas, and what is the true value of personas for product managers and marketers? Welcome Ask the PM and Coconut Eclipse and John Newberry, who are out in the Twitter sphere.
Yeah, so I think that the interesting thing about personas and trying to address this as we start off is that it's sort of one of the most hijacked words in our space. People use the word personas and they use it relatively loosely. So sometimes when they talk about personas, it's more profile. So it'll be about, you know, we're building a product for some type of demographic or segmentation. And sometimes when they use personas, they may be talking more about just, it's really not the pursuit of what we really call personas. Our personas are evidence-based, and they're looking at beyond the what. So when you hear people talking about, oh, we're building a product for a male or a female, and they're a certain age, and they have a certain income, they're really talking about segmentation or demographics. And if you've done personas of any type, you know that really what you're getting down to is not what people are doing, but you're understanding why they're doing it, what's the driver behind it, and how they're doing it. So what's the overall ecosystem? Trying to get beyond selling somebody something and understanding why they buy from you.
So it's really understanding who your customers are.
Really and truly understanding who your customers are. I think that when you say that, people who've done traditional marketing will say, well, we know who our customers are. They, you know, they have a certain income, they live in a certain part of town, they drive a certain car. And while those may be interesting places to begin, that is not who that person is at the end of the day. You've got to get down to their core. Why do they buy certain things? What do they include in their ecosystem? And especially kind of in this world where we're breaking things apart and using mobile phones and tablets and having experiences with brands in lots of places that we never have before, what's going to make me want to work with a certain company or brand in a given context? And what are the behaviors behind that that are going to really motivate me to buy from them?
How do you go about creating personas? Do you have some techniques that you'd like to share with us?
We do 125 to 150 tactical projects a year, and we probably do about 20 to 25 persona projects. And we've got a process in place that allows us to quickly collect sets of qualitative data and start to understand the patterns that are really important. People think when they go into qualitative data that it's unwieldy and that there's no way of mapping it. And really and truly, as long as you take each respondent and we process sort of in the moment. So as we're talking with users, we know the kinds of questions we're going to ask. And then after we get done, we start to map them to the other interviews that we may have had. And then the patterns start to emerge. People think it's really hard to do this work. You can start finding patterns for personas in about 18 interviews, which is really not that many. You're talking 2 or 3 days in the field or talking, and we really do suggest that you do this contextually. You miss a lot of things if you try to do it over the phone or even in a lab environment.
Okay, so when you say contextually, you actually go out into the wild and talk to people?
We do. We go in the wild. I have ridden tractors all over the world and talked to tractor operators in many countries about why and how they use tractors. And before we did that study, I didn't even know there was a difference in tractors. We do go to offices and to homes because it's really about what the person isn't telling you. That's more important sometimes to what you learn in this research than what they are telling you. If I meet you in public or I meet you in a lab environment or talk to you on the phone, there are things I can't pick up about you because you're going to present yourself in one way. But if I can get into your home environment or see your office or understand sort of some of the systems that you build to allow you to kind of reflect yourself in the way that you are, then I can start to get underneath. Well, you say you're organized, but you're really not. You want to be perceived as organized, but really up underneath, you've got a system that allows you to kind of keep the things kind of barely together as you're moving forward. Or, you know, you really kind of pick up that context outside the system. And we so often, when we're building products, think about just that product as a singular thing, and we don't often understand what are the impacts around it. How are people using products in ways we didn't expect, and what are the workarounds they do? So we love to do interface-based projects where people have sticky notes stuck around their screen, and those sticky notes almost always are something that's missing from the systems that they're trying to use.
Excellent. So I want to welcome our Twitter participants at MyBizMarketer and at Compelling Marketer, as well as Ask the PM, and also Coconut Eclipse, and John Newberry, who says that ethnographic in-depth approach seems to be the only way we've been able to build true user personas. That is John Newbery from the UK.
Yes, I would agree with that as a starting point. So to truly understand who your users are, you really need to get inside their environment and understand how they're doing things and why they're doing those things. To bring them into a lab environment and then get them to pretend or to act is sort of, it's very difficult. I mean, people, and they love to lie. Like, you know, you have to be really careful with how you set up those studies. But if you can get them in their own environment, sort of watch them do things, then you can build the patterns and you can predict who a person is later. So once you understand the patterns, it's my favorite cocktail party trick. When I'm doing a study, I can get personas down to about 5 to 6 questions. And so as I speak with people, I can put them into different persona slots based on how they answer those questions. But I have to have done the initial research first. I have to go out and sort of really and truly understand who these people are, how they work, and how they're going to respond to certain questions in order to then turn it around and have a hypothesis of, if I ask these 5 questions, then I'm going to know who that person is. But starting in the wild and starting in their environment is very important.
I have a question for Eric. Have you uncovered any surprising insights by actually, you know, you've got a hypothesis, you go out in the wild, you try to prove it or disprove it. Have you uncovered any really glaring sort of wow, aha moments?
We've had a ton of them, which is why I love the work that we do. I mean, customers bring us products all the time and they tell us why it's failing or why it's not succeeding. And we always listen to them. I mean, we don't go out doing these research projects under the hope that we're going to disprove their theory. You know, they'll say, yeah, we worked with one customer who told us that their reps inside a call center were fat-fingering the product ID number. And we went in and did the research project. We talked to 36 of them, and what we found out is that, number one, the system didn't allow them to fat-finger the product ID number. There was no way for that to happen. And the other was that they really just had a training issue. They weren't placing people through a good and appropriate training program, and the people who were going through and sort of being supported didn't have errors and mistakes. But the groups that were being brought in and sort of told to swim in the deep end were the ones that were really suffering. So we find those things all the time. And we did a study with boomer women around cruising. And they told us that this company was going to build a website for boomer women. And if you think about that, you build a site that was around empowerment and being an empty nester and sort of time of your life. Those would be the messages you would put together. But when we talked with the boomer women, we found out cruising had nothing to do with that life stage, and they really wouldn't be attracted to those types of messages. It was more about where the ship might be going was one of the major groups, so what was the destination. Another group was all about the ship because they wanted to party, so what are the casinos and the discos and those kind of things that are going on board. And then there's another group that just sees the cruise ship as a big spa, so they want to go and lay on a deck chair and have someone know what their drink is every day. So those were really the major drivers that could be used to build that site. And they're always a surprise. I'd say that we're rarely not surprised by what we learn. And that's so important going into this research, because you sort of have to get rid of all your preconceived ideas. We'll get a project in and think, oh, this is very similar to one we've done in the past. But there is some hypothesis testing you have to do to make sure that you're not putting the thoughts of one product or service onto the other. You know, people buy from products and companies because of an affinity to the marketing or an affinity for the product, even if they're within the same industry.
Tom at Compelling Marketer would like to know, is your approach to developing user personas different for businesses versus your approach for consumers?
Yes and no. The interesting thing about businesses is that businesses do have a persona. So when you're looking at a company has its own kind of persona to itself, and we do a lot of work in the business-to-business space. And what we find is that the business will have a persona, and then people who work for the business will have some tenets of the persona of the overall company. And the way you know that's true is if you've ever worked at a company and you were there for any length of time and you felt like you just didn't fit, you know, I'm just not part of this culture and it doesn't work for me, you're going to naturally migrate towards groups of people that are like you in certain contexts and also into companies that sort of work the way that you do. When we write business-to-business personas, we typically will focus on the primary driver for the product that we're looking at, because there is a difference between user and buyer personas. So you do need to understand both of those. I talked earlier about the tractor study that we did. And in the tractor study, there was a buyer persona and there was a user persona. And it was important to talk to each of them individually because the user personas were very heavily influenced by the buyer personas. The buyer personas were typically the manager, they've been there forever. And if you put users and the buyers in together, they would always defer to the buyer. The user would always defer to the buyer. But the funny thing is, if the buyer bought a tractor that didn't work in the field, if the users told them that this tractor was terrible, that buyer would never buy the tractor again. So it was important to talk to them individually such that you didn't end up with influence, because the users wouldn't tell you things in front of the buyer that they would tell you if you would talk to them one-on-one.
Wow, that's really interesting. So once you get the 18 personas worked out, what's the next step? What happens next?
You want to start with at least 18 interviews. So it's 18 interviews is the beginning of when you start to kind of see patterns and clustering occur. You really, depending upon the context you're in, may have to get into like 27 to 36 interviews to understand what you're seeing and what you know. And our approach is always to have two people on the project. So you have one person who's looking kind of at the overarching themes. And the problem with that person is that they'll sometimes be influenced heavily by one respondent, because either that respondent was very, you know, we all meet people that we really like, or we get into situations that are very memorable to us. And so you want to be careful that you don't allow that to bias the rest of the research. The second person is responsible for collecting data at a very granular level and making sure that the patterns match up to what the primary researcher is seeing. So if the primary researcher is saying, you know, money's a really important thing in this space, and the person who's working kind of as a secondary looking at the data says, yeah, but we only had one person really talk about that, then you're kind of checking each other. When you get into that 18 to 27, 36 interviews, you'll start to hear patterns. So people ask us, when do you know you're done? You know you're done when you know you're done, because you start to hear someone say, I'm very different from anyone that you've ever talked to. Or they feel like from a recruit perspective they might be very different. But as they start to answer the questions and you go through the protocol with them, you can almost predict what they're going to say next. It's very much like being fortune tellers, or, you know, I bet this guy's about to say this. And if you can start to predict those things and start to see those patterns, then you know that you have some clustering, and then it's a matter of sort of getting in a room and starting to break those clusters apart and know how they map to each other.
So the first question you suggested is, what types of data do you use to inform product decisions? So we're going deeper into, now that you have the patterns that you're able to map from those personas, how do you translate those into product decisions?
Yeah, and what we do is, once we have the personas created, we do what we call try-it-on exercises or socialization exercises. And what's really cool about that is, when you're building a product and someone comes to you and they use demographics and they say, hey, pretend like you're a 35-year-old female who drives a minivan and has two kids. I mean, I have a problem doing that. I don't know how to be that person, right? But if you give me a persona and tell me to put this persona on, the way that those people behave and what they say and do, it's very easy to explain that to someone and then have them sort of try that persona on and then look at the product from their perspective. And we'll do a set of exercises, things that you've seen in, you know, marketing groups and even some focus group facilities like SWOT, like strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So you're building a product and you're building it for a specific persona group. What are the strengths and weaknesses? And we'll often, even when we get done at the end of that, may decide that that product is not good for that persona and we need to go to someone else as the primary, or that there's some tweaks we need to do to it to make sure that it's going to work for that persona group.
Tom, Compelling Marketer, asks, is the active persona research any different than what product management should be doing to understand the market?
Well, I would say that smart product managers do persona research. I mean, the problem we have, the space we're in now, is in such a state of disruption. Many of us have kind of gone through the 1990s and, you know, done the dot-com thing. I did that. And during that stage, you were building a website, and you were building a website that had to work for 80% of the people. So it was, usability was more important then, and we talked a lot about that. But as we get into these, you know, smartphones and laptops and tablets and using information in lots of different places in the cloud and social media, we're breaking all those models. So you don't want to know what your users have been doing. You want to know what they're going to do. So how are they going to surprise us in this next year? You need to lean forward. And it's the product manager's job to do that. They're getting all these inputs from the marketing team based on, you know, numbers they're trying to hit, and their technology group is telling them the things they can or can't do. And I see the product manager as such a glue between those groups and saying, look, guys, you know, we can do all this from a marketing perspective and we can do all this from a technology perspective, but unless we really hit what our users want from us and expect from us as a brand, then we're going to miss the mark overall. And that's the person who holds that mantle in the company. And you can't rely on the data that you're getting that's kind of this blood data. You know, why do you care how many people clicked on something? You got to know why they did it.
So do you ever revisit the actual participants, like sometime in the future, 6 months later, see if they've changed how they're using it, why they're using it, or at what point does the data get stale and you have to start over?
The nice thing about personas, if they're done properly, is that you really do get to the core of who a person is, and you understand why they're making those decisions. And depending upon how close the context is, the closer you are within context, the less likely they are to change. One thing we do try to understand, and we always understand in our persona research, is what makes someone move from one persona group to another, if they ever do. Because there's some studies we've seen where when you are a persona, you are always that persona. And in transition is a very interesting place, because that's actually the biggest place to capture people. Let me give you an example. So we worked with a bank several years ago, and they wanted to build a banking website. And if you go look at banking websites, they're all about life stage, right? It's like, I'm about to retire. Where do I put my money? I'm going to go to college. I'm just getting married. And they all look at life stage. And so we did a study. It was a huge study around life stage. And what we found out is that the reason people pick banks have nothing to do at all with life stage. It has to do with the word convenience. But there are three big groups that think of convenience differently. Convenience for the person who's sort of neighborly person who likes to go to their local branch and deposit their payroll check every week and use the ATM, their idea of convenience is going to be ATMs and branches. So if you're messaging to that person, you want to say, we have the most ATMs and branches of anyone. They can transition to new personas based on two things. One is online tools. So they get introduced to the online tools, and all of a sudden they realize, I don't have to go to my branch, and I can bank anywhere. So I might be open to moving to like an Ally or another bank that doesn't exist as brick and mortar. And that means they're in transition. So they've moved from using local branches and ATMs to doing online, and that's a great time to capture them. If you don't have the best online tools, you will lose them if they go somewhere that has a great online tool. The other convenience word that we ran into is people who had complex finances. So they might have inherited money or started a small business or done something else, and they move into a category where they have to have a personal banker who knows them by voice when they call in. And so if that personal banker leaves one bank and goes to another, they are very likely to follow that banker to that new relationship. So for each one of those categories, convenience was they used the same word over and over again, but it meant three very different things. And to capture someone and to get them from a market share perspective, you had to get them in transition from being kind of the primary persona to one of those new personas. And disruption in technology is the best time to relook at your personas. So if you build a set of personas now, and then they come out with the latest and greatest, we don't know what it is next year, the iPhone equivalent, that's when you need to revisit your personas, because there's probably going to be a huge change in the way that they're using technology or using product or whatever, because their world has been disrupted.
And so this frequently happens. We have people who are tweeting, and they probably switched over to listening. Hi, people. thanks for listening, because it's so intense. It's really beyond what you can capture in a tweet.
It's beyond what you can get across even in a presentation. I'm doing several keynotes and presentations in the next couple of weeks and trying to condense it down and get all the information out. It's so much, but it's a great way of kind of moving forward with the way that we do product management and product development.
Yes, and that's my interest also in recognizing personas in terms of how you provide the narration about that product, about that technology. And I think that people are realizing that even from product conception, you need to segment the messaging different. So I'm not sure we have a question about, but at what point in time is it appropriate to start identifying the personas? And of course, before product development or building starts, I would think.
I mean, we say the earlier the better. What we run into is people try to build products that are one size fits all. We sit in rooms all the time with people building product, and they say, who is this for? And it's for everyone, or it's for this really wide range of people who would never even go to a cocktail party together, right? And so how can you build product based on that? If you're doing, and I say for consumer-grade products, so if I'm putting something on a shelf, right, in a grocery store, then what I'm saying isn't necessarily as top of mind or relevant, but as we have more experiences that even support those things. So you might have something you're selling in a grocery store, but you're using digital experience or advertising to support it. You need to understand what are the brand affinity, what's the brand markers that make me appeal me to that product. And so starting at the beginning is going to be cheaper for you, because what the reason customers bring us things is for one of two reasons typically. They're not getting the sales they expect, or they're getting too many support phone calls. And they call us sort of on fire, you know. We're not getting the sales we expect. We put something out and we're getting way too many support calls, help. And so we start off with, okay, well, who did you build the product for? And it's always this, like, laundry list of demographics, you know. It's a family with 2.5 kids. They make this much money. They live in this house, blahzy, blahzy, blahzy. And so we go off and do the research and find that that's really not who they're building the product for at all. And then they can do some low-hanging fruit changes, but we all know that once you've got product going through the life cycle, if you've built something that's incorrect and you've got to go back and retouch it, you may not be able to because you've already tooled for it, or you've got technology in place that's not going to support what they really want. And it's so much cheaper to kind of start this way, and it can even help you analyze, would we build the product? Because it's much cheaper to not build the product than it is to build a product that's unsuccessful and that you have to scrap.
So you would do maybe some very preliminary persona and going out in the wild when you're trying to do even the minimal viable product for a very small segment, or just to see what the reception for the particular product or proof of concept is.
Yeah. What we get, we are often commissioned tactically. So customers come to us because they have a problem, and they'll work with us on several tactical issues. You know, we want to make our search work better. We can't get people through a funnel. We're not selling enough of these journals, or whatever it is that they're having issues with. And then we'll do a couple of projects, and then they'll say, how can we not have this problem again? And so the way to not have this problem again is to really understand why people buy from you. And why they buy from you. That's an important distinction nowadays. You can't sell things to people. They buy from you. They choose to purchase your product. You don't. We're long gone are the days of Don Draper, even though that's one of my favorite shows. You know, I'm not selling you a lifestyle. I'm not selling you those things. You choose who you're going to work with, how you're going to associate with brands, and each brand sort of has its own archetype and kind of people that it attracts. And be careful, because if you do something that's incorrect, we've seen many brands put out things that were not in line with who they were as a brand, and then they cause an alienation of sort of their core fans and group that really support them, and they may not be able to hold on to the group that they've been attracted long term.
So the relationship management, or sort of the relationship that the consumer might have with the brand of affinity, is really important, and you don't want to violate that.
Incredibly important. And understanding who you are, and even if you want to be someone else, because we work with a lot of brands that will say, yeah, I mean, we understand that's who we sell to today, but we really want to sell to this group. There are ways to get there, right? I mean, Apple's an example of that, of somebody who's now, they sell tons of music, but they didn't come out. They didn't decide that overnight. You know, there was like a calculated choice around that. And people like to use Apple as an example, honestly, often of, you know, people who say, well, customers don't know what they want. I can agree with that, but they can tell you what's missing in the life cycle, you know, what they wish it would do, and you can start to fill in the gaps for them. That's what we get paid to do as product managers and UX people.
One of the next questions was, T2, is what types of data has been the most useful to you as you make product decisions? You may have touched upon that.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say that what we see customers coming to us with is a lot of what data, and we look at why and how. So we want to understand why people do what they do and how they do it. What is their overall ecosystem? And we don't care as much about what. And we also argue that, you know, there's often a discussion around quantifying how many of a certain persona group is. it's really more important to look at overall influence, so how influential is a group, because there are some groups that are incredibly influential but also smaller in size. And if you can get to those groups, you get everybody. But if you bypass them, you will never have as one of your customers, and you'll get the other, but you'll miss them. So you have to really understand that the old segmentation breakdown of data is, I guess it's my mantle I preach against often, is why do you care about that? Like, why don't you look at who you're really pushing this to and then understand what their influence is to the rest of the people within their ecosystem?
Do you find that clients are resistant to changing the way that they think about the data or about their market, or are they open to, I guess it depends on what state they're
in.
Yeah,
it depends on how terrible things are, right? I mean, it's like if we get, often when companies are in the at the point of having issues either turning the needle from an acquisition perspective or, like I said, too many support calls, and they're like, how do we not have this problem again? Or they're trying to change who they are. That's when they're open to looking at new things. But, you know, the larger the company is, the more they're likely they are to rely on older techniques and older ways of looking at stuff. Because that's sort of how they're honored often for safety. You know, if you have the numbers, you can come back and be like, yeah, but I have the numbers even though it didn't work. You know, but I don't know how long that's going to last. Yeah, I don't know how long just having relied on the numbers and still missing the mark is going to be an acceptable metric.
Okay, let's talk about, I think we've talked about number three already. What about question number four? What types of information would you like to know about your customers other than the why?
Well, you talked a minute ago about looking at customers over their life cycle, and we do a lot of work where we will end up with panels over time, so we may actually watch somebody kind of as they transition, especially if you're looking at the overall life cycle. And another problem you have as product managers or as companies is they all like to talk about their silo. You know, so if I'm responsible for support, then I don't really care about acquisition or marketing or some of those other things, even though when you're looking at a company, you think about them as it relates to all of those things. And if any piece of that breaks down, then you're going to potentially not want to work with that company. So doing more long-term views of these people, understanding them all the way from acquisition to sort of, you know, cradle to grave kind of concept is very helpful, because you can see them as they transition through your company and start to identify where you might have some opportunities for improvement and ways that maybe you're not actually fulfilling the brand message that you really want to put out there or the product message.
Okay.
We've talked about five.
We have talked about five.
Did I talk about that all the time? Yeah, and then we use one-on-one interviews, and one of the reasons that we do is we often will have people like to do what's easy. And so looking at quant data and looking at focus groups seems easier, because if I put out a question to a big group of people on a survey, I get all these responses back, and then I can say, oh, look, I had thousands of people tell me this. Well, did you craft the question correctly? Did they understand what you were really asking? And are you sure, positively sure, that the person at the other end was the qualified person you really wanted to talk to? And in those surveys, you have very little way of following up. So when you're doing one-on-ones, if somebody says something and you can read them, you can read their context, you can ask them additional follow-up questions and really get up underneath what they mean by that answer. The other thing that you run into with focus groups is people like to put focus groups together based on demographics or segmentation breakdown, and then they'll come out of a focus group and say, well, I don't know why, you know, we sort of got a mixed result. We ran four focus groups and two of them said this and two of them said that. It's because you knew who was in the room, but you didn't know who was in the room. So you knew the demographics of the people that you put in the room, but you didn't know if those people thought the same, if they had the same drivers at their core. When we build personas, we'll put focus groups together around personas, and those are very useful for both ideation and also validation of product, because we know why we're getting that result back, and we can really understand whether or not it's going to be successful versus having five or six females or males of the same age and the same income in a room together, and you don't really understand what kind of group bias may be there.
Yeah, that's the one-on-one interviews definitely kind of take precedence over the group bias, because when you're in a group, people may, depending on the relationship they have in the group, or they might just decide, oh, well, I'll just agree. It's just easier to agree.
Yeah, it's just easier to agree. I've been here for an hour and a half. You've given me my $100, and I've had my pizza. I'd like to go home. Or there's that, you know, I talked a minute ago about the tractor. There can be influence. You have to be very careful. People, you know, there's a unspoken order of importance. You know, if one person's perceived as smarter or perceived as whatever, then the group may acquiesce. No matter how good your moderation is, you know, we'll have customers who are like, make that person talk. Well, that person doesn't want to talk. I can't make them talk. And if I make them talk, then I may be forcing an answer that I don't really want. But, you know, when you get them in a room one-on-one, somebody who doesn't want to talk sort of has to, because they're there for an hour and they got to sit there with you, right? So it forces them to kind of give back more information than they certainly would within a group.
What's your idea or your definition of a durable persona? What sort of transcends, or which ones last?
I would say that as long as you're looking at something that's a core behavior for a customer, for someone, then it is something that will last. And giving you an example, there are spenders in this world and there are savers in this world, people who spend money and people who save money. And the chances of you changing that are incredibly slim, if at all. You will manifest your spending or saving in a different way. People like to point to extreme couponing, you know, the show that was on, I think, last year, as a saving thing. That is totally a spending thing. Those are people who want to spend money, and they have figured out a way to do it in which they don't really spend money. Or they'll collect points, or they'll do other kinds of ways of kind of manifesting that core desire. We have done enough of this research now that we know there's a persona DNA, and the persona DNA is very similar to like being male, female, or being a certain income or a certain age, but it has more to do with, you know, spender saver could be one of the factors. It could be, do you like to talk about yourself, or do you like to talk about others? And being a self-centered person, which sounds like it's bad, is a core, and it's not very easy for you to change that conscious decision to change that core. So the more you get to kind of core behavior and understand it when it's context, and then in context is like being a bank, deciding to go on a trip, those are things that are not as durable because those might change based on the kind of trip you're taking, financial institutions versus banks, like am I doing retirement versus like just checking and savings. So you have to really understand that you're looking at that.
So you're saying that personas have a core DNA, and that won't necessarily be affected by the context. Behavior will change with context, but their core DNA will not.
Right. It's how they manifest that core within that context. When we do these persona projects, it's always sort of disappointing because I'm almost always what we consider the worst persona. I'm the spender. I'm the one who sends my stuff to the dry cleaners. I'm, you know, like all that, right? And it has to do within those contexts of how I kind of manifest myself. So how do I, what are my expectations? Because I'm taking my core and within that context, I have an expectations. And one of my favorites is Kevin O'Connor, who's the president here at User Insight. He and I are basically the same age, same demographics, but we could not be more different. Like if you looked at the two of us from a persona perspective, our core DNA, what makes us at our core, is so different. Like I'm a Starbucks guy, he's all about Dunkin' Donuts. You know, I love social media. If he tweets, I'm like, golly, Kevin actually sent out a tweet. So, you know, there's like these core behaviors and core tenets within us. And if you look at us as demographics, you would be sending the same marketing messages to us, but we couldn't be different. We couldn't be more different.
Welcome, Nomadic PM. He asks, how do product managers evangelize the importance of personas within a company at all levels?
That is a very good question. And it's a hard question for product managers. You know, sort of what I've seen, because I was a product manager in the 90s, is, you know, trying to get our rightful position within a company. Because we really are the glue between all the different groups, marketing, technology, QA, all those people. And so you come in with these ideas, and you sort of sometimes have to start off very tactically and take some of the things that are being built and put them into some environments and have them tested. And those can be beer budget, just, you know, taking it and having someone try to go through a process and start to understand that, pointing out that, you know, oh, look, we've got these two people and they looked exactly the same, but they had completely different findings. I wonder why that is. You know, started putting in that fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and using some case studies. And companies like mine, we put up case studies all the time, and we have owned research that we have available on our blog and that we put out about different areas that can kind of give examples maybe in like industries or other places where they've worked well. I do realize that personas are sort of like a loaded gun. So we give people personas, and at the end, they either don't use them because they're scared of them. So how do I actually use this thing? Or they might shoot themselves in the foot because they start to try to use them and they don't necessarily understand the nuance. So companies like mine, and then there's others that do training around personas and how they work, can help you to do things like socialization exercises, which I talked about earlier, which we never give a presentation. We never go into a company and give like a 2 or 3 hour keynote presentation, because how boring is that? What we do is we help companies understand how those personas really work so that they can try them on and actually look at their products from the persona's viewpoint. So product manager does become an evangelist. They've got to talk about not looking at demographics or segmentation. They've got to ask some pretty pointed questions, especially to their marketing teams when they tell them what. So what? Like what? So what? 10,000 people downloaded it. Why? Who cares? You know, we need to understand why. And we understand what those drivers are and how they view us. And they can use that as an understanding of giving concrete, because the product manager is responsible for taking kind of what marketing wants to build and translating that correctly to the other groups. You can use personas to build incredibly powerful use cases and project briefs. Anytime we've worked with development teams that we've done persona work with, what they're thrilled about is that they get a brief and it's so actionable. They know exactly what they have to go build and what it's going to look like. So the information they have that's being passed from one group to the other is incredibly actionable. I don't know a better word, but it's a brief that is actionable and the use case that's actionable.
The more I delve into what needs to be done before building a product, the more I wonder how does anyone even have the gall to begin building?
Well, you know, at least if you know that there are things you should be doing before you build a product, you've made one step ahead, right? I mean, the audacity of a company to think that they can build a product without having talked to any of their end users and by just relying on a bunch of what data, I mean, that's such a slippery slope. And especially in today's world, I talk about the fact that things are so easily adoptable and so easily deserted. If I want an app on my phone, I can download it for free or 99 cents. And then within moments, if I choose that the content or the context that it's providing to me doesn't work, then I am out. And you will not probably get me back. So you have such a little short time frame. That decision window is so short. And there's so many alternates. You know, we're in this kind of many-to-many world now where there's so much selection around how people experience product and what it looks like and how it works, that you've got to make sure you're closer to the mark when you go out. Vendors have gone out with something and, you know, alpha and get feedback and then fine-tune it than to sit on it.
Eric, who are your major influencers, or who would you say are the classic product management resources and people that you admire, and why?
You know, I'm kind of an interesting hybrid. I've done startups, so this is number 10 for me. And I look at a lot of kind of entrepreneurial influences, you know, From Good to Great and Michael Gerber's E-Myth are two things that I've read a lot about, because, and I think they apply from a product perspective, because we so often focus on the wrong things. But, you know, Malcolm Gladwell and some of the stuff that he's written in Tipping Point and Blink and those spaces, you know, just really looking at that. Reading Steve Jobs, I read his biography at Christmas, and what I love about him, if you read that biography and you really understand him, this man was willing to take a product that was near launch and completely kill it. He would just kill it and not accept it wasn't about how they couldn't do something, it was about how they could, and sort of, you know, really knowing that they were focusing on one primary element of every product they put out, and his undying devotion to making sure that it was perfect. In some of the examples they talk about from his life, if it had been other companies, they would have been so close to launch, they would have gone ahead and put the product out, and that's why it would have been a failure. But he would take a product that was so close to launch and decide that it wasn't right, that they had missed some key element, and he would kill the whole thing and then start over. And that is brave, right? That is so brave to make sure that it's right.
Well, it takes guts to spend all that money and pay all those people and do, you know, maybe months of development or a lot of testing and then not release. That's tough. That's a tough call.
It is a tough call, but he made that call over and over again. If you read and truly understand him, for us in the space that I'm in, where we're talking about user experience and really understanding who your users are and what they are at their core, he's misquoted often, right? You know, it's not about, he was innovating and he was focusing, and it is true that users can't tell you what they want, but they can tell you what they're missing. They can respond to stimulus. They can look at things. And then as the smart people that we are in product management and user experience, we can translate that into what they really want or desire.
So where should a product manager start in order to understand what the core DNA is of the personas? Is it a step-by-step procedure? Is it an orientation, or is it actually a training that you need in order to do it right?
We hire people who are constantly curious and like to solve problems and try to figure out how you can do something, not why you can't. And it's about having a broad conversation with your user community, and it has to be unbiased. So, you know, if there's a way that you can get in front of your users and not wear the company logo and kind of go out there and be like, hey, I just want you to show me what you do and how you do it, and really and truly starting broad. So we often start off with, like, if we're building a website, let's go and talk about booking hotels. So you'll often, the conversations we'll see people have are, like, very myopic. They'll be like, okay, let's go to the internet and you can show me how you book a hotel. Well, that's terrible, right? Tell me about how you plan travel. You know, what are the sources you go to? What do you look at? Having those broad conversations, because the second you narrow the user to what your context is, then you've lost them to helping you with any ideation, because they may talk about a site you've never heard of, friends that influence them, other kinds of things. So, you know, I wish that I could point to some great book, and I probably should go look and see if there is one, but I haven't seen. Personas are so often shortcutted and done based more on profile information. It really is just being a good listener, not what I've done on this interview this afternoon, listening less and talking, you know, listening more and talking less. So making sure that you really kind of let them talk and watch what they do, and collecting pictures of those people and pictures of their context, and then starting to look at the overall patterns and being able to map people. And when you map them, they stay in one place in the map. So if you build an XY and try to put one of the things you think is the major factor on the X and the other on the Y, let's say in our travel example, you know, do they care about the hotel or is it more about the destination? Do they care about the amenities? You know, what are the things that really make people very different from each other, and looking for those patterns? I think it's getting in your user's context and really having an honest and authentic conversation with them, and watching what they're doing and really focusing more on what it is they're asking for than what you're trying to push across.
A lot of times product managers will be just so short on time that the segmentation, it'll just be one more thing to check off the list. This is done. Due diligence was done, when there's a whole other level. You're saying it's almost better not to do it than to do it wrong.
Yeah, and I would say, too, though, if you can take some time, and I'm talking like 2 or 3 days within your calendar of your product life cycle to have those conversations, it does a couple of things. One is you don't have to tell people a lot of stories when you start to talk about why you're making a product decision. If you can tell them one story about a user that you sat with and you watched them struggle with a component, or they really asked for this, it becomes magic. It's more magical than the what, you know, all the numbers that the marketers may be putting out or technology is telling you they can't do. If you can be like, yeah, but here's video or here's audio of this respondent that I met with and hear them struggle. People love stories, right? It's all about storytelling. So that makes you an authority for the space, and it also gives you a strong backing for why you're doing what you're doing and the decisions that you're making as a product manager.
There has been some great comments out on Twitter. John Newberry saying, there's no secret to building really great user personas, simply a case of listening and taking the time to understand. Do you think he was distilling?
Yes, a little bit more concise. That's a good way of putting it. People think it's magical. It's no more difficult to do that than it is to put together a set of focus groups, you know? And the value behind it is so much greater.
So we had listed some great resources at the beginning, one including a Foundation of a Great User Experience from UX Magazine. There is also a video of Eric talking about personas, which I think actually went out on the press release. And for more information...
Well, you can certainly follow me, so I'm at E. Holtzclaw, And that is, I think, been in the tweets. You can also follow at User Insight. We're putting out content that we come across that we think fits really well in this space. We have our own blog, and our strategists put out weekly insights, and we have also a group that's looking at personas in social media, which is a really interesting application of personas. They're very authentic in social media, so once identified, you can start following the conversations of those people and then see how they're influencing each other. And the Vimeo that you put out in the press release, I think that's like a 35-minute conversation at the end of the social media TV summit that we were doing. And that has a lot of really good kind of information about what personas are and how they work and why they work. We make people who start here at the company watch that to get an understanding of what personas do and how you can use them. And the social media TV project that we did last year is very interesting, and it's completely documented on our blog. We walked through the process of how you build personas from beginning to end and did a 9-month engagement last year where we built a set of personas at the intersection of social media and television.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Eric.
Thank you for your time.
Lisa, excellent questions.
Thank you so much for having me, Eric. It was really fascinating. I was listening really hard.
I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun talking to you guys this afternoon.
Great. Please follow us at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK, where our podcasts are available from every week to listen on demand. You can listen on iTunes, and also we have an Android app. Just search for PRODMGMTTALK. Thank you to our sponsor, the AIPMM. Please follow our tweets at prodmanagement talk for product events coming up, product camps, webinars, and details about next week's talk. Thank you again, Eric from User Insight and Lisa Winter for co-hosting today.
Thank you.
Have a great week.